the stage and got a clap. That's brilliant. This is where I get to boost my self-esteem for the next hour, pretending I'm a pop star with this on the stage. Good evening. It's great to be here. We're going to be talking about thoughts a lot tonight, and I must say, as I stand here and look out at you all, the main thought in my mind is just how completely terrifying you all look. I'm sure you're all very nice, but at the moment you look really, really scary. But it's great to be here and to see so many of you interested in this area of self-esteem. And I think it is a really important area for us to be thinking about, particularly in the church context. I think it's something perhaps that is brushed under the carpet quite a lot, and so it's really good to have you here and to be able to talk about it tonight. Most of you know me, but for those of you that don't, just a few words about me. I'm Catherine Haddo, as Ben said. I became a Christian about 10 years ago, about a year after my husband was converted. So we've been married for 16 years. We have 3 children, aged 11, 9 and 5. And I've got a really good view of you all up here, so I'm watching, so be good. We lived in London all of our adult lives, really, but we moved to Wiltshire about a year ago, and that's when we came and joined North Bradley here as members. And I've been a practicing psychologist for about 12 years, and I specialise in working with people with stress and anxiety disorders. So that's a bit of background about me. As Ben's mentioned after the talk, please don't rush off. We've got refreshments out the back. There's some amazing looking cakes out there. Also, just to say, over on that table are some books. They're books that I've used as references for this talk, so please have a flick through them. You might find them interesting. Please don't wander off with them. But if you want to note down the details and buy one, they're all really good reads. I would recommend all of them. There's also a few handouts on there, which are applicable to some of the things I'm going to be talking about tonight. And also there is a little pen and paper thing over there. If you've got questions after the talk, please just jot them down on a bit of paper and pop them in there, and then perhaps when we're having coffee, I'll have a look through and see if there's any that I can answer. It's probably easier than taking them from the floor, because it's actually very hard to hear what people are saying from the floor. So that's what we're going to do afterwards. And I really hope that you'll get a lot from tonight. It's really been a blessing to me actually writing the talk and preparing for it. I've been surprised what I've really learnt as I've been doing it. So I hope that you'll take something of value away with you tonight. If you Google self-esteem, you'll be hit with just a mass of book titles, most of which encourage you to be empowered and banish your low self-esteem for good. They then proceed to tell you how to fly around on a self-esteem high and say you can conquer the world for the rest of your life. There's also a mass of websites that have varying degrees of helpfulness. One of the websites that I was just looking at when I was Googling about it was proposing a plan of action for you if you had low self-esteem. And it went something like this. It told you to eat properly. Make a list of goals, such as listening to positive music every day. Go around and give compliments to people, and don't be negative. And talk with friends, and hang up signs around you with lots of positive words on them. So, if you'd like to hang some signs with positive words on them, how about some of these that were also online? You're always with yourself, so you might as well enjoy the company. Or never bend your head, hold it high. Don't belittle yourself, be big yourself. And my personal favourite, I'm so cool, I want to date myself. So there you go. If you want to feel better about yourself, that's what you need to put round the walls. Although saying that, I did find one amongst them which I thought was worth hanging up, and that said, you are not what others think you are, you're what God knows you are. So there was something I thought of interest in there. But on a more serious note, there's no doubt that low self-esteem is extremely damaging to people. It plagues the sufferers of it with negative and destructive thoughts day by day. And for Christians, it really impedes our daily walk with Christ. It stops us from knowing the true freedom that we should know when the chains of the past are just taken away from us with salvation. And in the work that I'm doing at the moment, I'm seeing more and more people really emotionally crippled by this issue. And it's also really frightening just how many youngsters are coming up with issues related to self-esteem, and it's really quite frightening. So if only it was as simple as just going around and pinning up helpful quotes on your wall. So what I'd like to do tonight is spend a little bit of time talking about self-esteem, because I think one of the issues is it's not very well understood. The semantics of it are a bit confusing for people. So I'd like to talk a bit about what it actually is, how it manifests itself in people's lives, then some of the things that psychologists can do to help people if they're struggling in this area. And then I'd also like to share with you some of what I believe God teaches us about our value and self-worth. So first of all then, I think it's gone on pause. Let's have a look at what self-esteem is. So it's basically, at a basic level, it's the belief and confidence in your own ability and value. And it's a term that's used to reflect someone's overall emotional evaluation of their own worth. So it's a judgment of yourself, but it's also an attitude towards yourself. And at one end of the emotional scale, we've got high self-esteem. And if we have high self-esteem, what it usually does is elicit emotions of triumph and pride. But at the other end, we've got low self-esteem, and that often elicits emotions such as shame and despair that just plagues people. And if you look at much of the secular self-help world, what it tries to do is it's designed to take low self-esteem and shift you over to high self-esteem and to just give you that feeling of triumph and pride. But as a Christian psychologist, I think I differ from many, because I'd argue that neither of these states are one of optimal emotional well-being. So I think the purpose of people when they're trying to seek self-esteem seems to fulfill a God-given need that we all have for acceptance in relationship. But for most people, the way they go about fulfilling this need is by looking to external pegs to fill it. So for adults, it just shows you some of the things up on the slide there as to how they might do that. So people might look for a sense of achievement, whether it's in their job or sports or qualifications. Maybe it's in good relationships that you have or an effective performance. Maybe it's in the material possessions that you have or how attractive you feel towards others. Maybe it's just being a good parent or a good grandparent. Maybe it's just feeling loved or being approved of by others. Maybe it's being a good, morally upstanding member of the community or at church. And as well as the external pegs that we see there, it can also be focused on internal pegs. So, for example, it might be focused on your understanding of your own fitness or your weight, or your looks, beating personal bests in exercises. And if you're a teenager or a young adult, perhaps that focuses in a slightly different way. It's more likely to be on body image, on your clothes, on material possessions and what your friends have. Or it might be part of being with the in crowd and needing to know that you're in with them, even though you might not agree with what they do or say. And today, of course, we have the additional delight of social media phenomena to add to all those external pegs that we use. So I wonder if perhaps the blogging, tweeting and Facebook posting explosion that we see is really a sign of people's deep-rooted desire to be heard and understood and valued. So how many followers do you have on Twitter? How many Facebook likes do you get? How good do you feel if loads and loads of people are liking something you've done on Facebook? And how do you feel negatively about yourself if nobody does do a like for something you've done on Facebook? It's all about positive self-esteem building. Facebook doesn't even have a not like button. It's all just about positive feeding. How often do you actually look on Facebook if you use it and just see someone saying how awful they feel about themselves, how just rubbish they feel, how undervalued they feel? And if they do take this really brave step of just letting this be known to people that are reading it, how weird does it look, when people say they like it because they have no other option to respond in any other way. Of course, what we also have now is the delight of selfies. If you don't know what they are, you stand there taking photos of yourself and then you post them to everybody. I was in Laycock Whitehall Garden Centre about a week ago and stopped with my little one for a coffee, and we were sat at a table next to two ladies who I'd guess were maybe mid-30s in age. And the conversation went something like this, one of them holding up a mobile phone saying, "This is a selfie of me as I was going out that night." Her friend says, "You look gorgeous." She then flicks through and gets another one. "This is a selfie of me waking up in the morning with no makeup on." Her friend responds, "You look gorgeous." She shows another one. "This is me when we went out the other lunchtime doing this. You look gorgeous." Then comes another one. "This is me when we were out doing whatever it was. I wasn't really listening. You look gorgeous. Oh, who's that man? He's really dishy." And this is how the conversation just went on and on. How do you think that lady doing the selfies would have thought if the woman, her friend, had said, "Actually, you look pants without makeup"? How do you think that is going to affect her? And it's all just about building it up and building it up. And it really does break my heart to see someone who perhaps I've sat with that morning sobbing their heart out, utterly broken, and then you look at their Facebook postings that show them doing something just meaningless and showing out how great their life seems to be. It's really sad that we have this facade that we like to show people to get approval. And just to be clear as well, the number of friends that are in your friends list in Facebook doesn't mean that you actually have that many friends. Perhaps true friends would really, really know what you're going through in your life, and they wouldn't be liking these posts that are put up there so much. So there are others that won't post on social media, but they read it all the time, and they are utterly crippled by feelings of not having a life as good as others do on there, because they believe that is what is actually going on in the people's lives, and they're actually struggling with deep depression because of it. So please, if any of this resonates with you or people that you know, Facebook and all this social media is not about real friendship or real lives or even real communication. It's all very, very false. So let's just have a think now. What about us? What are our pegs? Some of what is in this talk was actually used at another talk I did back in London a while ago, and some of that was taken from a run that I was doing when I was thinking of various things, and I'm almost too embarrassed to share this with you, but for the sake of this talk, I will let you into the sadness of what my self-esteem sometimes goes like. So this is my run going around Richmond Park, and these are what I'm thinking. Does my bottom wobble more or less than hers? I know she's faster than me, but I haven't had to stop and walk. Look at that bloke's bike over there. I wish I had one like that. And I must beat the time. The hubby said I would do it in. I'll show him. And I did. Yes. I wish I could look like Alistair Brownlee when he runs. And these are the sort of thoughts that are just going on in my mind the whole time that I'm running. I'm not proud of these thoughts, I must say. And it's also really nice to be reminded that God has a sense of humour, because when I had just thought the second one about that lady stopping, it was rather ironic that one of my running pins came loose from here and my race number flapped into my face, almost blinding me. So actually I had to stop to pin it all back together. So it's nice to know that God has a sense of humour. But does this way of valuing yourself when you're trying to peg yourself on external things around you actually work? Well, the sad thing is, to a point it does. Because if you believe, and it's reinforced by others, that you're top of your field, whether it's in work or parenting or church or school, whatever it is, if you believe you're successful in your job, whether you're doing well financially, or you think you're a really good mum because your toddler never has tantrums and everyone else's does, maybe you're great, think you're a great church secretary and everyone says you are, then finding your self-worth and acceptance pegged on these things will work. But the problem is, it's always going to be temporary. and what happens when it stops or changes. Because when people are hanging their self-esteem on this whole range of pegs, if the peg is taken away suddenly, and sometimes it is suddenly, then it exposes you to just the full force of all the negative beliefs about yourself. Because the reality is, people do lose jobs, relationships do fail. If someone has pegged their self-esteem on internal factors rather than external ones, fitness levels and personal bests go as we get older. We put on weight, our looks fade, so do our mental abilities. We suffer illnesses and problems, and suddenly our high standards start slipping. So before you know it, your personal self-worth is just gone, and the emotional disturbances this creates just forms a whole range of emotional, physical, and behavioural problems for people. Here's just a list of what often happens when the pegs are taken away from you. So we start having self-downing beliefs coming through our mind. We become self-critical. The stress and anxiety levels increase. Perhaps eating disorders or self-harming starts. Perhaps we get depression or just sheer frustration at ourselves or others. Perfectionistic tendencies start arising. We constantly fight to manage. Destructive relationships start forming around us, and that makes us feel worse about ourselves. And we become very, very demanding of ourselves and others. We sometimes manipulate to start boosting our self-esteem. And what we've done is we've fallen into what's called the self-esteem trap, because, of course, the only way we can get out of it is by pegging ourselves on things more and more. So when I'm working with clients, I use the cognitive behavioural approach. And as a Christian, I feel this is the psychological model that best fits with Christianity, because it focuses on people's thoughts and then perceptions about events, and then the subsequent consequences of those beliefs, whether they're emotional, behavior, or physiological. And I think this reconciles really well with what we're told in the Bible, because we are told, aren't we, as Christians, to use our minds, our thoughts. We can see in Acts 17, the Apostle Paul reasoning with Gentiles and Jews, with Epicurean and Stoic philosophers. And as we start thinking differently, then our beliefs and perceptions start changing. You can see in Acts 17:34 that some people became followers and they believed. So once our thoughts have changed, our behaviours should change. So repentance, it's a turning away from unhelpful behaviours to better ones. And this in turn then affects our emotional response. And our emotional response will always be the last one to change. It's true, I think, that feelings are poor leaders but really good mirrors of the heart. But so often what we do is let them lead us rather than accept them as a result of our thoughts and behaviours. We look at it the other way round. So the essence of the cognitive behavioural model is from the starting point that events in themselves don't cause us anxiety. It's our thoughts and perceptions about them that do. This is really important. So events in themselves don't cause us anxiety. Our thoughts and perceptions about them do. Let me give you an example to illustrate that. Back in London, after the tube train bombs happened, there was a huge influx with people suffering quite serious panic attacks on tubes, something that I experienced myself for a while, and it's really, really unpleasant and debilitating to have panic attacks. And what you would get people saying is, tube trains give me panic attacks. And that was the response that they would get. They were paralysed at the prospect of getting on tubes or indeed any form of public transport sometimes because they were so stressed about it. But when you start talking to them, using this example, let's look at what we see. So we say to them, what's the person opposite you doing? And they might be reading a book. What's the person next to you doing? And they might be texting on their mobile phone. The person on the other side is having a chat with their friend. So this immediately disputes the claim that tube trains cause panic attacks. What is actually the case is the thoughts that are going through this single person's mind is that the tube train is going to be blown up or is going to crash, and it's those thoughts that are causing their panic attack. So as soon as you get to that level of thought process, you can start changing it, and that's when the behavioural and emotional response changes. But what often happens is people start having these thoughts and they continue and they continue. And we very quickly spiral down into a pattern of negative physical, behavioural and emotional disturbance. If we look directly at the self-esteem example, I hope this will just illustrate it a little bit. So if we look at the picture of this lady who is... Sorry, did someone say that was just me? Oh, no, just me, sorry. This lady on her bike... Let's just assume she's usually very good in the races, but on this occasion she's not. So the activating event for her, the trigger, is that she's not going to win this bike race. And we can see from here her beliefs suddenly start spiraling downwards. I can't maintain my high standards. What's wrong with me? I'm a failure. If we fly over to see to the consequences of that, what we see here is emotionally she's anxious, she's angry, she's frustrated. Behaviorally, her focus becomes very, very weak. And physically, she'll be tense. She might get an upset stomach. The D and the E, the disputing and exchanging thoughts, are what I'm going to come on to later. But you can see how this spiral starts, and then you can be fairly sure when she goes into her next race, she's going in with these beliefs that she's not going to be able to do it. And so the spiral continues downwards. So psychology can do a lot to help people to tackle self-esteem issues. But when you're working with someone with low self-esteem, it's really important, I think, to focus not just on giving them high self-esteem, as many self-help books try to do, because although this can give a really quick boost and a short-term gain and makes them feel better, it's just as temporary as the external pegs. But rather what we want to do is aim to encourage emotional resilience through an understanding of self-acceptance. Because after all, we're all fallible. We're all imperfect human beings. So we need to move towards accepting that in all of us, there is a lot of good and there's a lot of bad. And if an individual can move towards self-acceptance instead of seeking positive self-esteem, suddenly it starts reducing stress, anxiety, worry, perfectionistic demands. They all come downwards. So where some people would, particularly in the secular world, would look at seeing self-esteem on a continuum of low at one end and high self-esteem at the other, I would suggest as a Christian psychologist, the continuum is with self-esteem at one end, whether it's low or high, and with self-acceptance representing the psychologically healthy end of self-esteem. And whether it's low or high self-esteem, that's at the psychologically damaging end, in my view. I know some wouldn't agree with that, but that's what I think. So what can we actually do to help people move along that continuum towards a more healthy psychological state? I just want to give you a few examples of some simple methods that we can use to start helping to tackle this area. And broadly, the techniques fall into two main areas. Firstly, it's changing the underlying physiology that's going on in this response. And secondly, it's changing the thoughts to encourage more helpful behaviours and emotions. So you can see from the slide there, they're inextricably linked. Again, if I just give you an example, perhaps I was planning on going out for a run, but it's a really, really miserable day and I'm sat nice and snuggled on my sofa and I really don't fancy going out. If I sit there, I'm probably going to feel rather sluggish, probably feel a bit guilty later on because I didn't do the run I was planning to do. But if I force myself to get off the sofa despite not remotely feeling as if I want to and go for a run anyway, the change in my thought to get me up off the sofa and do it leads to the change in behavior of getting my running shoes on and going out. And I can guarantee that within 10 minutes, I may be wet and cold, but I'll be feeling emotionally much, much better. And when I get back, I will certainly be glad that I did it. So it's just a very simple example of how forcing your thought process to change triggers the behavioral and emotional response. And remember, the emotional response is always the last one to change. So firstly, I just want to go through the physiological side of things, because whenever your self-worth is undermined and attacked, your body actually produces a very real hormonal stress response. And if you're working with someone with self-esteem issues, one of the side effects of this is it makes them think very, very emotionally. So it's very hard to get them thinking in a logical way. So what we start to do first of all is look at the physiological side of things. Anyone here ever get or regularly have cold, clammy hands? No? Good. Anyone here, as they're dropping off to sleep at night, ever get a massive twitch that jolts them awake? Okay, yeah, you need to listen carefully to this bit then. There's stress hormones causing that. So just two things that I want to go through here for the physiological side of things, and there's handouts on these over there if you want to grab them afterwards. So the physiological side, we can do a lot to help people in this just through very simple methods. One of them is mental relaxation imagery, and another is deep muscle relaxation exercises, because it essentially squeezes these unhelpful hormones out of your muscle groups that have been building up. I know that people think that relaxation, when you say you must be relaxed more, is really, really wussy, and couldn't you come up with a bit more than that? But just want to spend a few minutes going through the stress response, because there's a lot more to it than that. On a serious note, just before I start that, anyone here a bit squeamish? Feel a bit funny when you start talking about bodily fluids or functions or anything? No? Good. Prefer to know if anyone's likely to faint. Although I did do first aid training this morning, so I'll know exactly what to do if anyone does. No, seriously, some people, as soon as you start talking about bodily fluids and things, they're straight over. So let's just have a look at what is going to happen in the stress response. There undoubtedly exists, I think, an unhelpful view in society that stress is just all in the mind. And if you're experiencing it, you're weak in some way. But the biology of the stress response clearly shows a very, very real physiological process that occurs in the brain and in the body whenever you're faced with a stressful situation. Some processes are very, very quick. They're instantaneous. For example, if you step out in a zebra crossing and the car hasn't stopped, our body's primed to react to that very, very quickly, thankfully. But today, the problem is that in society and the way we get anxious and stressed about things, these things just keep going. The stress response is never switched off, so it's a constant process going on in us. So I'm just going to describe a bit about the biology of the stress response. And hopefully this is just a very basic, simple explanation. But the hypothalamus in the brain basically gets messages from our senses, and that sends messages to the automatic nervous system. And this is what controls our hearts, our lungs, blood vessels, stomach, glands, everything like that. And then the automatic nervous system responds to this received information. And depending on whether the information is processed as being as a threat or not, determines which component of the automatic nervous system is more dominant. So if it's not very stressful, it's fine. The parasympathetic nervous system will be most dominant, and this just keeps our body in a relatively relaxed state, nice state of equilibrium. But if the messages that we're getting are perceived as stressful or scary to us, the sympathetic nervous system takes over. And one thing that's really important to know is that when the perception of the demand is considered, it doesn't make much difference as to whether the threat is real or imagined. And this is what's happening a lot in self-esteem. It's not a real threat to us. It's an imagined one that we've done in our mind, but it still triggers the same stress response. So that's when the sympathetic nervous system starts producing all the stress hormones ready for our flight or fight response to deal with it. And when these hormones are produced in our body, they create physiological adjustments to the bodily organs. They also create psychological and behavioral responses. So the psychological responses might be increased mental activity, mood swings, feeling overwhelmed, sleep issues, things like that. Behaviorally, our reactions might be trembling, rapid talking, pacing, lots of yawning, increased urination. These are all sort of responses that come from that. And if the threat is perceived as being needing a flight or fight response, then hormones are produced, and noradrenaline is produced more if it's a fight response that's needed. And this gives you a feeling of being all pumped up and ready to go. It's a feeling of being a little bit angry that I'm being in control and someone is trying to stop that. But if a threat is perceived as stressful but quite scary, particularly in phobia work, for example, what we get is an adrenaline response. And this gives us very much a feeling of being out of control. You might get a thudding heart in your chest that you just can't get rid of, and you have a very, very strong desire just to flee. So here's just some of the things biologically that the sympathetic effect will give you. So your blood pressure increases. The increased heart rate diverts oxygen flow to the muscle, different muscle groups. It's diverted away from muscle groups not really needing it into those like the heart and the leg and the arm muscles in preparation for action. Body temperature in extremities reduces as blood's directed into the organs that really need it. The spleen contracts and empties stored red blood cells to increase all the oxygen supply in your body. The salivary glands reduce, causing quite a dry mouth. And there's a big decrease in all the gut muscles, so the activity reduces and you might get a feeling of butterflies in your stomach. Sometimes this can result in a sudden vomiting or diarrhea effect if there's a big stressor. The lung muscles dilate, increasing all the airflow available for your body, and your eye pupils dilate. The liver and fat tissues mobilize, and all the sugar and fats go around your body for increased energy, and the blood becomes more able to clot, ready in case there's injury. So, if the stressor is immediately removed, great. The parasympathetic nervous system comes into effect and everything reduces back to a nice equilibrium. But when it doesn't, and this is what typically happens, if there's self-esteem issues or generalized anxiety disorder, then another part starts to kick in, the pituitary system. And then we get a cortisol effect as well. This starts regulating sugars and fats more, increases our blood pressure more, and it reduces all the inflammation and immunity and pain effects are suppressed. But this is really, really damaging because the high levels of cortisone long term are really, really troublesome for us. They cause burnout and breakdown, cause a lot of serious long-term health conditions, partly due to the ongoing suppressed immunity effect. There's a massive increase in hypertension and cardiovascular disease as the continuous fats are released into the body and they stick to the walls of the arteries and cause narrowing. Of course, eventually they tend to drop off and then we get an increased risk of clots and embolisms. And there's some studies starting, I don't know how accurate they are, but apparently there's a 20% more likely increase to have a heart attack on a Monday morning. And they think this is due to the massive adrenaline spike that causes ruptures of the plaque in the arteries. So perhaps have Mondays off, that would be good. Everyone feeling okay? Nobody's suddenly feeling squeamish. But after all of that, the good news is that we can learn to exert a degree of control over the sympathetic nervous system. And this is the basis of some of the relaxation and imagery exercises that we do. And I'm hoping, Ben, you're going to come and help me with something. You want to come up here? This might fail horribly, Blue Peter style. But I'm just going to try and demonstrate something with Ben. just give us a second while we get set up. This is going to be really hard for Ben to do because he's in the spotlight. And I'm just going to ask you to relax. Can you all hear that? Yeah. So this might fail horribly, but Ben has been for a while now hopefully practicing some relaxation, deep muscle relaxation exercises, and just going to let shut your eyes and relax. Ben, Romeo's out the field and he's gone trotting off down North Bradley Road. You're driving along the M4 to London to a family meal and your oil lamp's just come on the dashboard. Car's broken down on the Chiswick roundabout for about 4 hours. You're going to be late to your family meal again. Okay, that isn't working quite as well as I hoped. Oh, wow. But well done, he's chilled. He's a chill customer. There you go. Thank
just
you.
Happens so often.
You're just immune to it. There was an effect, though. I don't know if any of you picked up on it. What that machine is doing is detecting changes in the temperature to his extremities, which will change quite quickly with the stress hormones. And as I say, he's been practicing these exercises for a while, which allows him to sort of calm the whole sympathetic effect down. But what you find, and there was a minimum change in that, I hoped it would be a lot more dramatic than that. He didn't know I was going to say those examples. His wife gave them to me. What you often see is, even though there is no threat to him at all in the room, you know, the horse is in the field, I believe, and his car is in the driveway, just the thought of those things happening would be enough to trigger off the stress response in his body. But it didn't happen as dramatically as I hoped it would. But thank you anyway, Ben. But the good news is it does demonstrate that we are able to, through these types of exercises, exert a degree of control into the automatic nervous system. This is really good for calming the stress response. Excuse me, I must just have... It's my mouth going dry from all my stress hormones. This is why the cognitive component, the thinking component, is really, really important, because it's not a question of what something makes you feel. It's rather what does it make you think, which is what we want to look at. Because if we can alter how someone thinks about an event, whether it's real or imagined, we can change the stress response as to how they're going to activate it. And this is really good, for example, if you're working with someone who has phobias. And then when you change the thought response, this changes the behaviours, and then the emotions follow. So let's just have a little look at the cognitive side of things. This is, it's not very clear up there. There are handouts over there of this. But this is some examples of cognitive distortions or unhelpful thinking styles. And these are what cause emotional disturbances that block goals and encourage really, really unhelpful behaviours and emotions. And they become habitual. They become a response that we naturally turn to when we become anxious. And normally, we might have one or two favourites that are our comfort zones that we go to. Perhaps you recognise some in yourself. So a mental filter, for example, only noticing your failures and never your successes. Or magnification, blowing things massively out of proportion. I'm able to do that fantastically about medical matters of all kinds. Overgeneralization, reading something into a pattern where one thing happens and you assume the rest is the same. And this is the top four, all or nothing thinking, overgeneralization, mental filtering, and disqualifying the positive. Are really, really common with someone who is suffering from anxiety around self-esteem issues. So I just want to go through a few cognitive reframing exercises. These are two really, really simple exercises, because depending on the typical thinking style someone is demonstrating, you would use a slightly different exercise to do it. But this is two really, really simple ones that I just want to take you through, which start breaking down the person's thought process and start challenging them to think about things in a different way. It's good as well to be able to demonstrate things visually to someone, because that helps them connect at a mental level to it. So the first one is just a very simple fruit bowl exercise, which goes something like this. You've got a gorgeous bowl of fruit there, bananas, oranges, apples, pineapple, I think there is plums, really, really nice and tasty, and it's just pleasurable. Everything about it is good. You start munching away a few grapes, and as you pick one up, as always seems to be the case in our house anyway, there's one lurking under there that is green and squishy and mouldy and horrible. What do you do? Anyone? What do you do? Anyone can answer? No? You'd throw it in the bin? What, just that grape or the whole lot? Just that grape. Okay, anyone else? So that's a sensible... Thank you. Hello, just noticed you. yeah, absolutely. Most people would just pick that one out and throw it in the bin. But that's not what we do with ourselves. What we often find is that if we look at ourselves as this big bowl of fruit, we find something about ourselves that isn't very nice. It's a bit mouldy and squishy, and we just wish it wasn't there. And we chuck the whole bowl of fruit out. We label our entire self based on that one horrible grape. And away the whole gut thing goes. It just, I'm seeing a few nods around tea. Resonate with this? Yeah. So when you can start getting people to link into this sort of way of thinking, they start seeing that this is what they're doing to themselves. This is a really good way of starting to talk and change mental filtering or all or nothing thinking. Another one that is based on the same thought processes is called Big I and Little I, which I've made really confusing by doing a big C there. But the reason I've done that is me, I'm Catherine, C. And it's good if you can personalize it a bit for the individual. So if your name is Ron, you would do a great big R there, or Marg, you would do a great big M. And the purpose of this exercise is to ask a person to think about things that are good about themselves, not so good about themselves, or neutral about themselves. And every time they come up with something, you would either put a positive C, a negative C, or just a neutral C, or a R if you're Ron, or an M if you're Marg, just to illustrate positives and negatives in all of us. Then you would ask them to do the same. What would their friends say? What would their family say? And you start building up this picture. And what it starts showing them is that you can't logically rate your whole self as bad or weak or rubbish on the basis of tiny little components. The only thing that you can do is acknowledge that there are some aspects of us all that we might like to change, and there are ways we can work with them to do that. We can help them to take responsibility for small changes and action plannings. But the reality is we're all fallible. So we need to acknowledge those areas and improve and address them. But we're all made in the image of God. There is some degree of good in all of us. And it starts helping them to see that picture more clearly. When we start pulling together both the physiological change and the thinking styles change, the cognitive component, quite quickly we start seeing behavioural changes coming on board, and as a result the emotional improvements start. Obviously there's a big issue in this about readiness to change, whether the person is in fact ready to let go of those unhelpful thinking styles, but that's a different matter. So a lot of people, I think, you know, want to know, prevention is of course better than cure. So how best can we actually go about helping our children to not get to the situation where they're falling into this self-esteem trap at all? Because without realizing it, I think as parents, we often do a lot to encourage this self-esteem trap thinking from a really early age. If we just use for an example moment, the game Pass the Parcel. When I was young, we used to go to parties. You'd pass the parcel round and you'd rip the wrappers off, and some lucky child would get a pack of sweets or whatever it is in the middle. And there'd be a bit of moaning from everybody else, but the party went on. Having three youngsters myself now and going to lots of parties, I don't know if this is common of Wiltshire or not, but when you do pass the parcel these days, every time a layer is ripped off, somebody gets a prize. Does that happen in Wiltshire as well? Yeah, yeah. So, but what we're actually doing, I can absolutely appreciate why we do it. We don't want our children upset and feeling sad, but what we're actually doing is we're protecting them from learning to deal with failure. And this is actually starting to encourage at a very early age them pegging their self-esteem, their feeling good about themselves, on succeeding, whether it's at ripping layers off a parcel, or getting into schools or GCSEs or A-levels or whatever it is. So we start reinforcing this from a really, really early age. And there are a number of things, I think, as parents, we can do to help nurture a really strong emotional resilience in our children. And I think, arguably, I think psychological resilience is the bedrock of emotional well-being. And I think it's something that we can help our children at any age, actually, particularly if they're younger, but it's something that we can start working with our children. So what we want to do is help nurture really strong emotional resilience in them, and that's defined as an individual's ability to properly adapt to stress and anxiety. And it's really important that this shouldn't be confused with stoicism, because if there's a showing of no emotion during adversity, that might indicate an incomplete processing or indeed denial of the adversity. So it's not showing no emotion, but it's actually adapting to stress and adversity. And there's a lot we can do to train our children in helping to do this. And a lot of it involves being able to find positive meaning from misfortune and the setbacks that we all have in our lives. There are four main components to it that are listed here. So it involves an ability to make realistic plans and follow those plans through by the relevant steps. It's a degree of confidence in our ability and strengths. There's a lot about communication and problem solving that's important. And I think perhaps really importantly, it's the ability to manage strong impulses and feelings. I think as adults struggling with anxiety, what a lot of people do is they just run. That there's a refusal to sit and deal with it, and they just run away. And that reinforces this cycle over and over again. So the ability to manage this strong impulse and desire is a really, really important thing that we can teach our children. And it's not a trait. A lot of people say, oh, they're emotionally resilient and I'm not. It's not. It's not a trait at all. It's a process that can be successfully learned or improved on. So I just want to go through a few areas we can do with our children. It doesn't matter what their ages are, really, but obviously the earlier that you do it, the better. So the first bit really is to encourage flexible thinking, because there's always more than one way of seeing an event, even if that is difficult to see at any point. And of course, we only know if they're learning flexible thinking if adaptable behaviour is shown as a result. So that's one thing that we can start doing. Another thing is encouraging them to move out of their comfort zones and develop a tolerance for experiencing emotional discomfort. And this is something that we really lose a lot as we get older. Another is increasing their high frustration tolerance. And this is something, I hope my son won't mind me using him as this example, but 9-year-old James there, if you don't give him food for about 2 hours, he'll stagger into the kitchen about to collapse and claim that he cannot stand it for a second longer and he's about to die. The reality is he's just eaten 2 hours ago and he's clearly not going to die. But by increasing them gently in their high frustration tolerance, it shows they can stand it and they can bear emotional discomfort. Another thing is helping them to keep things in perspective. Again, another example this afternoon from Kezi, my little one, as she staggers into the kitchen and flings herself on me, sobbing, because Daddy has beat her 3-0 at Uno. And the conversation was, I'll never win at Uno. I can never do any games ever, as she sobbed away. And clearly, that's not true. Last week, she beat, you know, the time before, she beat him 3-0, but she's lost sight of that in this current thing. So helping them to keep that in perspective is another really useful thing. And it's all about, it might not be nice to have emotional discomfort or even physical discomfort, but you can stand it, you can bear it, and you, with help, you can get through it. It's about encouraging small, manageable goals in problem solving and encouraging a really good sense of humour, especially the ability to laugh at themselves. It's really valuable in developing this psychological resilience. And also, when they're upset, asking, is there another way we can think about this? I know this is what you're thinking, but how else could you think about it? And that's really, really helpful. Another way is, how else could we deal with this? So behavioural change, how could you respond to this differently? and getting them to learn very early on clearly the link between behaviour and consequences. Obviously, this is really, really good for discipline. It's also good as they get into the teen years and like lazing around and perhaps not doing much. If they're going to laze around feeling a bit grumpy, it's just going to continue in that cycle, and it's about breaking that thought cycle. So they're just some of the bits and pieces that we can help. There's also a very positive thing in allowing safe and secure failure. So sometimes you just know your child is not going to be able to do something that they want to do. And obviously I'm not suggesting that you allow them to go and hurt themselves or anything like that. But safe and secure failure and helping them through that is a really, really good way of helping this emotional resilience. Playing name that emotion is really, really powerful, because a child might just come to you and say, I'm really angry, I'm angry. But the question is, well, what is it that is making you angry? The anger is the outpouring of the feeling to do with the emotion. What's the emotion? And perhaps the emotion is, I'm jealous because my sister's been given more attention than I have, or she's got a toy that I really want. So getting them to look at the actual emotion there is very helpful in being able to change it. Specifically around self-esteem, things like encouraging and praising godly characteristics. How often, if we remember ourselves as parents perhaps, when did we ever say, or how often do we say, you really persevered at that, I'm so pleased with you, compared to you look really pretty in that dress or with those hair bobbles? It's about praising external things and comments about their appearance and everything like that, rather than what's going on inside. So we need to celebrate others' achievements with them and show that they're loved and valued, however different they are to other people. And I think as well, challenging self-pity and it's not fair attitude. Treating you equally does not mean treating you the same, and that goes back to the pass the parcel example. And if we can start to do this in our children, it really helps them to build this emotional resilience to protect them a bit in the teen years, as the self-esteem issues really come to the fore. But ideally, of course, we wouldn't really have to be doing any of this. We wouldn't be looking at psychological techniques, because we wouldn't be seeking acceptance in this way. We wouldn't be trying to protect our children in this way. So why is it that we're actually doing it? And the reason is this, because not only are we fallible, but we're fallen. If we go back to the beginning of time in Genesis, we see Adam and Eve together in perfect unity and acceptance between themselves and with God. It says in Genesis 2:25, the man and his wife were both naked and they felt no shame. So there's no doubts, there were no fears, it's just contentment with themselves and each other. But we know what happens next, don't we? Eve took the forbidden fruit and she ate it. And we see the consequences of that happen very quickly. The Lord God called to the man, "Where are you?" And he, Adam, answered, "I heard you in the garden and I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid." God said, "Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree that I commanded you not to eat from?" The man said, "The woman you put here with me, she gave me some fruit from the tree and I ate it." And then the Lord God said to the woman, "What is it this you have done?" And the woman said, "The serpent deceived me and I ate." So the fall happened, and immediately the perfect acceptance and belonging was gone, and it was replaced by unhelpful thinking styles. So we see blame and guilt in that passage. And the behaviours changed. They hid and they covered themselves with fig leaves. And suddenly the emotional discomfort arrives. We have shame as their perceived weaknesses and defects are publicly revealed. If we go back to my run example, look at what all the examples are, all the thoughts that I'm having. Look where they're rooted. It's in the fallen nature, isn't it? Vanity, pride, inflated ego, coveting, idolatry. It's all the fallen nature. It's worshipping idols. It's looking for satisfaction in material things. It's seeking acceptance from the world and looking for meaning in everything other than the only true meaning giver. It's what the Christian author Graham Bainan, and some of his books are over there, he calls it our distorted identity rather than our intended identity that God gave us when he created us in his image. And the more we look at the world for society and affirmation, the more likely we are to get hardened and self-absorbed if it's high self-esteem, or despair and bitter if it's low self-esteem, because we compare ourselves to others and we don't measure up. But either way, what we're doing is we're fearing or needing man more than we're fearing and needing God. And it says in Proverbs 29:25, fear of man will prove to be a snare, but whoever trusts in the Lord is kept safe. So instead of looking to society for our self-worth and value, we need to be looking to God and him alone. Because when we see our value through his eyes, we see ourselves as we were always intended to be. But unlike the external pegs that we cling on to for our value and worth, God doesn't change. He doesn't have bad days. He doesn't make mistakes. He doesn't turn around and need to get rid of surplus resources. He doesn't swap us for a better model when we're fading a bit. He always loves us. So the acceptance and value we have from him is perfectly stable and secure. And he just loves us perfectly through his grace, not by anything we achieve or how we look or what we do. Because Jesus paid that price for us on the cross. It was when our status was categorically not liked that we read, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. And through his sacrifice, we've got a relationship that's restored with God, haven't we? And when we truly trust in this, we start to understand our value, not through the world's eyes, but through God's. And even though God sees absolutely everything about us, and that's really scary, he still loves us and he still accepts us when we've trusted in the cross. But so often we just fall into the trap of believing the lie that society's believed. And it's the lie that says we have to look and act a certain way to be accepted. Let's just quickly look at a few Bible verses that if we've come to the cross and trusted in the death of Jesus, this is what we've become. So you're loved by God. He gave his one and only son for you. You've become a child of God. You're adopted into his family. You're loved completely the way you are. Psalm 139, you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive even my thoughts. You're being transformed constantly into Christ's likeness. You're exactly what God intended you to be for his purposes. And I think just the awesomeness of this last one really just struck me when I was writing this. You've been chosen by God. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you to go and bear fruit, fruit that will last. Might be useful, I think, if we just all shut our eyes just for a minute and just reflect on that. I have been chosen by God. Because it's just huge. He's chosen you. And I think when we really get that into our mind, we start seeing ourselves in a little bit of the way God sees us. Christian author Edward T. Welsh, who two of his books are over there, really good ones, What Do You Think of Me and Who and Why Do I Care, and When People Are Big and God Is Small, he says that the heart of the matter comes down to three questions, and whether we have these questions right in our mind, the answers to them. The questions are, who is God, who am I, and who are people? And if we've got these answers wrong in our mind, we're going to have unhelpful behaviours and emotions coming from that. Let's just have a look at a few examples. So first of all, if we believe that God is someone who's far away and doesn't care about us, and that I'm just nothing and I'm alone, and other people are someone that I put my hope in and they let me down, I'm likely to go around feeling rejected permanently. Also, if I'm fearful, if you're believing that God is angry at you and you're vulnerable and you're just waiting to be pushed away by other people, this is how you see yourself, and other people are threatening to you, you're going to have the emotion of fear coming from that, and the same with jealousy too. But if we get those answers right in our mind and we see who is God, someone that's holy, he's holy and it's expressed in his love and justice. Other people are people that you can enjoy and serve and love. And then if we ask the question, who am I? I'm someone who's intended to be like Jesus, and by God's grace will become more that way as I go through my journey with him. I want to live for him rather than myself. When we start getting the answers to those questions right in our minds, suddenly our perception about ourselves starts changing. So if you're a Christian here tonight and you're really struggling to appraise your self-worth, or perhaps you know someone who isn't here and they're struggling, I just really encourage them to go back to the cross and ask God to help you to believe that you were truly loved and accepted by him, even if you don't feel that you are today. A few weeks ago, we had A.D. Taylor Weeks preaching here at our anniversary service, and he was talking about how a healthy church is secure in God. And as I was thinking about this sermon in the week after, actually it's just as applicable to us, I think, as emotionally healthy individuals when we have our security in God. So thank you, A.D. Weeks, if you ever hear this, for this part of the talk, which I've unashamedly plagiarized from him. But A.D. was saying security comes from four different places. He says we're secure in the plan of God, the purpose of God, the character of God, and the grace of God. So in the plan of God, God might not be in our plans, I know he wasn't in my plans until 10 years ago, or my husband's. But if we're in his, he will carry that plan through to completion, and he'll help us and he'll mold us as we do that. Philippians 1:6 says, he who began a good work in you will carry it on to completion until the day of Christ. Secondly, we're secure in the purposes of God. He's always called people out of the world to be his own. And this is all rooted in his eternal purposes for us. Thirdly, we're secure in the character of God. And this is really important, I think, to understand correctly. Because if we just have an make up in our own minds what God is like, we're playing really Bible pick and mix. We're just choosing the bits we want, and we're leaving out the bits we don't like. We've essentially created an idol in our heads about him. It's the character of God. He's all powerful. He's all wise. He's the perfect judge, and he hates sin. He's sovereign and holy with perfect moral purity. He's got perfect knowledge, never changes, and he's faithful to us. Finally, we're secure in the grace of God. Grace, of course, is complete and undeserved favor from God, and it's purely his choice given out of love through the death of Jesus. It's grace at the beginning, grace that will lead us on, and grace that will bring us home. So perhaps if you're not a Christian here tonight, can I really encourage you to perhaps look at the evidence for Jesus and who he is, why he came, and how he can repair your relationship with God and transform you through giving you the right relationship with God. It says in Matthew 7:7-8, ask and it will be given to you, seek and you will find, knock and the door will be opened to you. Everyone who asks receives. The one who seeks finds. And the one who knocks, the door will be opened. So ask God to reveal himself to you. Perhaps think about coming on one of our Christianity Explored courses that we run here a lot. But again, Graham Bainan asks a question. This is from his Mirror Mirror book. It's over there. It's really good. What mirror are you looking into for your identity? Because he's saying, if you're looking into the mirror of the world, going to get a distorted picture of yourself, and it's going to fluctuate depending on what's happening. It completely depends on how you compare to others, and you'll have this constant feeling of insecurity as that those measures go up and down. You need others, or you feel very threatened by others, and you're worried and uncertain constantly about who you are. And as a result, life always revolves around you, your importance, and you. And the focus is always on your performance and your achievements. But if we look into the mirror of God's word, suddenly we start seeing the true picture of ourselves, and that's stable. It doesn't depend on anything we do. It depends on God's declaration. And it gives us security. And that security leaves us free to love others and to serve others. We have just a constant assurance, because life revolves around Jesus and his importance, not us. And we could just focus constantly on God and what he has done for us and what he is doing. So we don't need to look to the pull of society that says we need to look a certain way or do certain things or believe certain things to have security and value. because the Bible shows us in a very different way. We're valued in God's eyes in our completely broken state. We're accepted by him through grace. All we have to do is come to Jesus on the cross and ask for forgiveness of our sins. It's understanding who you really are in Christ that starts to help you to know a value that is permanent and it won't change. It's not on external pegs. And even if we lose our grip on him, as we sometimes do in our walk, he never, ever lets go of us. He just remains holding on to us firmly. And he never lets us go. And when we know this, we discover our value and identity, the identity that God really intended us to have. And then that helps us to use, acknowledge and use the gifts and abilities he's uniquely given each of us to serve him and to serve others. If anyone is in Christ, that person is a new creation. The old has gone and the new has come. And when we trust in the cross, we're made right with God. We're loved and we're valued by him. And when we see ourselves through his eyes, we know we're accepted and we can stand secure in his light. What more do we need?